it's not the inequality that's causing people to die. It's the process whereby people are being allowed to get rich by harming other people.
In this program, Nobel laureate Angus Deaton on how mortality rates among white middle-aged Americans have stopped their century-long decline and why those without a bachelor's degree are much more likely to die of despair.
Inequality is deeply involved, but we see inequality and deaths of despair as the joint products of a system that's really working very badly.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards. With progress and development comes longer lives. That's what should happen, and that's what has happened in most advanced economies. But in their latest book titled Deaths of Despair, Princeton economists Angus Deaton and Anne Case describe how mortality rates in the U.S. have flattened, even increased, for non-Hispanic whites in middle age. More Americans between the ages of 45 and 54 are dying from suicides, drug overdoses, and alcohol-related diseases, with the largest increases in mortality happening among people with lower education levels. Angus Deaton is a professor emeritus at Princeton, as well as a presidential professor of economics at the University of Southern California. He was invited by the Institute for Capacity Development to present his research to IMF economists. Professor Angus Deaton joined me after his presentation to talk about the BA-non-BA divide in the United States. So you started this research with a hunch that the woes of the middle class in the U.S. were somehow different than in other countries. How did you come to zero in on bachelor's degrees as being the culprit or at least a culprit?
Yeah, it wasn't really a hunch. I mean, you know, we were playing with data, and then something jumped out of the data that we didn't understand, which was this long-sustained decline in mortality in midlife had suddenly stopped and partially reversed itself, and that this was among white non-Hispanics. And we looked around, of course, for what was causing that, which is what led us to the deaths of despair, meaning the causes of death. But also we compared it with other countries, and we saw that it wasn't happening in other countries. And then we looked around for what information we had on those deaths, you know, who they were, where they were, what sort of people they were. And of course, we're working at this point with individual millions and millions of death certificates, 20 or 30 million death certificates. And there's not a lot of information on those death certificates. You know the time and place of death and all that sort of stuff. But they do have education on them. So we just took what we had, essentially, and discovered that the split between a bachelor's degree and a not bachelor's degree was incredibly important for these rising deaths. And they were basically confined to that group. So that was just, you know, what was on the certificate, what information we had, and you use what you have. But then when we went on to look at other related things like morbidity and pain and church going and wages and employment, all of those seemed to be just very strongly structured by whether or not you had a BA or not.
And as you just mentioned there, the impact of this goes way beyond just the economics of it. It's a human tragedy in that people are dying from the sheer lack of prospects. And hence the title of your book, Deaths of Despair. How specifically are people dying generally? And what percentage of the working population are at risk?
Well, I mean, you know, at risk, of course, is the whole population. We don't know if it's like with suicides, you don't know who didn't kill themselves, sort of idea, except you know who did, so you can't really tell who were the people who almost did it. But it's clearly at-risk population is people without a BA. We spend a lot of time looking across the country, and it turns out that these deaths of despair, as we call them, are rising in every state of the United States. And that, you know, the decline in life expectancy, which happened between 1914 and 17, and will probably happen again in 2020, is widespread. There are a few places, a few states where death rates are not going up, but they're just like two or three of them, maybe New Jersey, California. That certainly will be reversed. But it's pretty widespread. And so it seemed like, you know, from the late 90s up until the mid 20-teens, whatever you call it, you've got a situation in which the death rates really are going up in midlife in a quite wide, geographically widespread way.
But in, you know, in terms of you know, lack of prospects for less educated people in a globalized world, the U.S. is not unique in that respect. Why are we not seeing this same phenomenon or those same trends in other countries?
That was a big question right from the very beginning, you know, because that was one of the first questions we were posed with. And if you look at figure one in our very first paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, that's what you see, that this is happening to less educated people in America and it's not happening elsewhere. So what's the story? And, you know, throughout our research that led up into the book, we were trying to figure out, you know, why America and why not elsewhere? And what you said, you know, globalization, by the very definition of the word, is a global phenomenon. So are robots or automation. Mm-hmm. There are German robots as well as American robots. So it couldn't be that. Or if it was that, there was something in America that was making it much worse than elsewhere. And there are, I think, three possible stories you could think about here. And they're not mutually exclusive. One is that the sustained decline in wages for less educated people is much more sustained here than it is elsewhere. We've had more than 50 years of it now. Other countries have seen some of that, but for much shorter periods. The second thing is opioids. So, you know, we do not, you know, we have not prevented the widespread prescription of what are essentially legalized heroin. And other countries have done that. Also, other countries have a social safety net, which is much more complete than ours. So for the people in Britain, for example, whose market wages or market earnings have not done very well, their actual take-home pay has done much better. And there's no such compensation in the United States. So you can imagine all of these causes sort of intertwining. The big question, of course, is, and this is what the Europeans are most interested in, is it just a matter of time before it comes there, or is there sort of American exceptionalism?
So you point out there, you know, the issue of the healthcare system in the U.S. And, you know, while your book was in fact published only weeks before the pandemic became a real thing, do you think this problem played on how prepared or ill-prepared the U.S. was for this pandemic?
I wouldn't exactly say that because, you know, other countries like Britain, which has a national health, a fully socialized healthcare system, didn't do very well in the pandemic either. Mm. Though they seem to have come through it, but their death rate per person is much higher even than what is happening in America. So you really can't say, I mean, no one was prepared for a pandemic that we've not seen for 100 years. And some people came through it very well, some people came through it very badly. You can look ex post and see what helped, but it was much harder ex ante to say what would help. But as the COVID goes on, you can see the problems with American healthcare that we'd identified and everybody's identified really coming home to bite. Because after all, you know, in other countries, you don't lose your health insurance in the middle of a pandemic because you lose your job. And that, of course, is a huge issue. And then there's the other shoe that has still to drop, which is who's going to pay for all of this? And, you know, American healthcare is incredibly expensive. You may finish up with more than 1 million people having been in hospital with COVID in the next year or so. And that's going to run up enormous bills if they charge it anything like their standard rates. And someone's going to have to pay those. And I think that could cause severe social unrest and other problems.
Hmm. That's a good point. So where does inequality fit in into this story? I mean, we blame a lot of things that are wrong about society, you know, on inequality. Are these deaths of despair a result of rising inequality in the end?
No. We just don't buy into that narrative at all. And, you know, I know the IMF likes to do that and says that inequality is bad for growth and all sorts of things like that. But I've never bought into that. Inequality is deeply involved, though. But we see inequality and deaths of despair as the joint products of a system that's really working very badly. You know, I wrote a book called The Great Escape, which argues that it's precisely during periods of prosperity, periods of innovation, times when things are really going well, when people are discovering new things, that inequality expands. So that's good inequality. I mean, that's inequality that's happening because progress is happening, and progress never happens evenly. But there are other sorts of inequalities, and one of the big inequalities in the U.S. is that, you know, the people who make money out of the healthcare system, the providers, the hospitals, the CEOs, the pharma companies, they're getting rich on the backs of people. I mean, they're basically stealing stuff. So, you know, some people are doing very badly, other people are dying, and out of that, people are getting rich. So in some sense, you know, the pharma companies who make OxyContin are a sort of poster child for this whole thing. It's not the inequality that's causing people to die, right? It's the process whereby people are being allowed to get rich by harming other people. So that's the central way that we think about this, which is that, you know, inequality is being produced by a process, and it's the process that's bad. You can have processes that produce inequality that are good processes. And I think it just makes no sense at all to think of inequality as a cause of anything. Inequality is an outcome.
And so you do speak a lot about, you know, rent-seeking in this book. Remind us of what rent-seeking is exactly and how it plays into this story.
Right. So rent-seeking is a fairly old term. I think it goes back to Gordon Tullock, who probably used it first. It's been around in development for a long time, too. And the idea is, you know, well, one way of putting it is people say there's two ways of getting rich. You can get rich by making stuff, or you can get rich by taking stuff. Mm-hmm. And rent-seeking is using the government, using political connections to take stuff. And so, you know, if you're a firm and you're manufacturing stuff, if the markets are right and they're working properly, you follow the profit motive and, you know, it helps make you rich and it benefits lots of other people, you know, Adam Smith's key insight. On the other hand, you might discover it's much more profitable to go and make a campaign contribution or send some lobbyists down to Washington, and then they give you special regulations which help you at the expense of your competitors or your consumers or your workers and so on. That doesn't produce anything. In fact, it's likely to destroy GDP, but it benefits you at the expense of other people. So that's the sense, that's rent seeking, which is you go and try to seek for rents from the government, which will help make you wealthy. And, you know, that's quite common in politics around the world, but some systems have much more of it than other systems. And, you know, the rent-seeking story and deaths of despair is sort of at the key of what we're doing. So inequality is just incredibly important in this because rent-seeking causes inequality. But the answer to that inequality is to stop the rent-seeking, not try to tax it away.
So rent-seeking is not something that we hear a lot about in terms of systemic risks. And there seems to be a convergence of pressures on society now, like, you know, artificial intelligence, health, education, and this political lobbying, you know, things that economists have not traditionally focused on. Is the field of economics entering a new era, do you think?
Well, I think it's been entering, you know, a new era for a long time. One of the things that's always encouraged me about economics, and sometimes I get infuriated by some of the silly things that are going on, is that it is very open and it changes very radically. And it's changing now. I mean, one of the things that's always interesting, you know, the American Economic Association has this list of terms it uses to categorize its literature. And they're always miles out of date compared with the best work that's going on. And the best work is different and it's changing. So I think two of the big trends in economics over the last 20 or 30 years, one of them had been to incorporate politics and economics much more closely. So Alberto Alesina, who died a few weeks ago, very sadly, was a leader in that and bringing politics into economics. I don't think it's an accident that he was Italian. You know, Luigi Zingales, who's another Italian writer who writes a lot about rent-seeking and political economy. So that thinking about the problems, many of the problems being political problems rather than economic problems, I think there's been a huge change and a huge move for the good in economics. The other side is sort of behavioral economics and thinking about people as not behaving as fully fully rational, intertemporal maximizers, and having all sorts of biases of one sort. And those two things together, I think, have been a very powerful set of improvements. And certainly in my previous book, In the Great Escape, in thinking about economic development, you know, the last chapter, which is about why aid doesn't generally work, is all about rent seeking and what aid does to rent seeking.
So in this latest book, you speak of the long-term benefits of going to college, but in the world of COVID-19, with classroom teaching a thing of the past, at least for now anyway, and affordable internet connectivity, a lifeline for students, do you worry that people's ability to pursue an education will be further hindered by corporate interests and their lobbying power in terms of making affordable and adequate internet available to everyone?
I'm not, yes. I mean, the simple answer is yes, I worry about those things a great deal. And those will be the lasting inheritance of this pandemic. And they'll be very serious ones, I think. I'm not sure the corporates are particularly at fault here. So let me take that out of the equation for a minute. There are all sorts of things where it intersects with corporate behavior. But just the two things, I think university education is going to be very severely disrupted. And I don't think we'll go back to where we were before. And I don't know. It's too soon to see where it is we're going to go as part of this. But I think lots of colleges are going to go out of business in the U.S. There are about a million foreign students here. We're already seeing the Trump administration fighting over that and to back off the stone round. There are about 300,000 Chinese students in U.S. higher education. It's a little hard to imagine that number not falling pretty rapidly over time. That'll put a lot of universities, colleges out of business. But I'm most worried, I think, is the school kids and the ones in the, you know, less economically favored families for whom, you know, Zoom learning is no learning at all.
Yeah.
And I think there's data showing that. And it's quite terrifying. And I think we know from the research that sociologists and economists and psychologists have done over the last 20, 30 years, that these childhood losses you lose in childhood are incredibly difficult to make up. It sort of blights your life. So this could be a situation in which long after the virus has been forgotten, we're still suffering the consequences of it, or some people are. And that will certainly widen inequality because it's not the people on top who are suffering under this.
So you're a busy man with lots of demands for your time. Why did you feel it important to talk to a group of IMF economists about this book, you know, an international institution whose main focus is essentially financial stability? What can these deaths of despair in the U.S. Teach us about the global economy?
A lot, I think. And But let me start with the question. I discovered that I've done this a few times before, and I certainly didn't do it. I discovered there's always a good lunch. There was no lunch. I discovered that I wasn't doing it for the free lunch. It's a real treat to be able to talk to a bunch of people who are very skilled, very smart, and who have a lot of influence in the world. And so, you know, just getting the message out there, I mean, that's what we really concern about. I imagine a few of them even bought books yesterday, but that's not our main concern. I think, you know, one of the big things that we talked a little bit about was let's hope that this marks the end of austerity, for instance. And austerity has been very, very bad for less educated people in rich countries. And, you know, Britain, which I know best, has been a place where there's been, you know, a terrible hollowing out of public services on which ordinary people really depend. And at the same time, well-off people were doing really very well indeed. I think the healthcare thing is very important for people in the IMF to know about because, you know, you guys go around the world. People come to you in times of distress and say what we can do. And it seems to me healthcare expenditure is an item that ought to be on the agenda. It's perhaps most seriously on the agenda in the U.S. And maybe the IMF is only occasional influence in the U.S., but it does have some. Right now, it's not clear who you talk to in Washington to have any impact on anything at all, right? I was contrasting that. I was talking to my friend Tim Besley the other day, and he was talking about, you know, how he, you know, he's not in power in any sense. And I was talking to Nick Stern, who's, you know, a crossbench lord in Britain. He's not in any political party. And they were both talking about, you know, how much influence their work and other economists' work was having on what's happening in Britain. And you just don't see that happening here at all, which is very sad. So let's talk to people who have influence when I can, and the IMF is certainly way up there.
Professor Angus Deaton, so great to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Angus Deaton is a professor emeritus at Princeton, as well as a presidential professor of economics at the University of Southern California. He won the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics in 2015 for his work on consumption, poverty, and welfare. Deaton spoke to economists at the IMF's Institute for Capacity Development about his latest book with co-author Anne Case, titled Deaths of Despair. Go to imf.org to find out more about the work of the Institute for Capacity Development and possible training opportunities. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe if you like what you're hearing. And follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.